There you go.
And then you need a share screen, right?
Yeah, when they the presentation. Is that the only presentation?
I put it together. So as long as they were, I had it was tricky with the formatting. So I when I put it in at first, it kept the source formatting, and it. So I have the other ones just in case it doesn't show up properly.
We gotta share it.
I just want to make sure it looks okay. Yeah. Okay, I think we got it.
We gotta still gotta share it. I get it. There you go.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Welcome, everyone. We'll get started. This is the departmental meeting for biostatistics. It is not 7:62. Thanks, Joe. So we have some guests from the school who'll be with us. So I'll make just a few brief remarks and then get out of the way. Just a little bit of good news. So next month at the departmental meeting, I will give a state of the department, and Kevin Anstrom will give a state of the coordinating center. So I'll sort of review achievements of lots of different things that have happened in the department over the last year or so. But these are just a few recent bits of good news that we've gotten in the last few weeks that I wanted to share with folks. Bonnie Shuksa received a K award probably more than a few weeks ago, but this is a really exciting work on causal inference and infectious diseases. So please join me in a round of applause congratulating Bonnie. Those of you who went to JSM in Portland last month already know this, and if you're following us on X, you would also know, but we've been promoting the announcement that Joe Ibrahim won a very distinguished Wilkes Memorial Award. This is one of the most distinguished awards that a statistician can receive. The previous winners are like a who's who of statisticians. So congratulations to Joe Ibrahim. And then just within the last week or so, I learned about two new grants that the department has received. The Coordinating Center under the leadership of Anastasia Ivanova, Kevin Anstrom, and others received a approximately $4 million supplement to the Large Backpack Awards. That's great news for the Coordinating Center. And then Bai Ming has just received an R01 as well. We learned about that earlier in the week. So great news on the grant funding side of things. Then I just wanted to thank Todd Schwartz for getting together the rosters for the departmental committees this year. Those have been finalized and circulated. We hope to hear from the chairs of these different committees at subsequent departmental meetings. So Todd will be reaching out to the chairs of each committee to see when you all would like to present and give us an update on all the great things that are going on within your committees. Just a few upcoming events I wanted to mention. The school is being re-accredited, and that's done through CEEF. And CEEF will be doing their on-site visit October 9th, 10th, and 11th. So you may see some external visitors on-site, and that's an important event for the school. We'll have fall break the 17th and 18th. As I mentioned, the next departmental meeting will go to State of the Department, State of the Coordinating Center. As I hope you all know at this point, we have the 75th anniversary celebration coming up for the department. You should have received an invitation, at least one from us about that by now. You should have also received information as a faculty member and or as a student how you can register and use departmental funds to cover the registration if need be. Now, especially for faculty, it would be better for the department if you use personal funds to register. Now, not everybody may be in a position to do that. And if you're not, then your educational funds are available alternatively. And Wes Winkleman sent out an email to everybody clarifying exactly the steps that should be done. But from a planning perspective, if you all could go ahead and register so we know that you're coming and we have a head count, that would be very helpful. So that will be November 11th and 12th. We're really excited. We have a great agenda. Sir Dennis Gillings and his wife, Lady M, will be coming. They'll be here a few days beforehand as well. And that Monday night, he'll be giving a keynote talk. So it's going to be really exciting. We hope to have many of our alum come back to Chapel Hill and join us. That will be at the Carolina Club. And then, the 75th will end and we'll immediately transition to a festriff for Michael Kosarok, which will take place on the 12th and 13th. That will also be at the Carolina Club. I think at this point we have promoted the festriff less, so you may or may not have received any information about that, but we will be getting out that information very soon. And then mark your calendars, December 5th, we will have the department holiday luncheon also at the Carolina Club. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Suzanne Maman and Naya Villarreal. Did I say that right? If you ever go to the School of Public Health graduation ceremony, you will know Naya because she has the pleasure of reading out the names of the graduates, which each year there are more and more of them as they go across the stage. So they're going to talk to us a bit about all things global. Yes, Suzanne.
Thanks for having us. We'll make this short, but Naya and I have been going around to each department and just sort of giving an overview of who we are in the Office of Global Health and sort of what's our scope of work, talking a little bit more about international travel requirements, which I know is a very popular subject among faculty and staff. Then Naya, I'll transition and let Naya talk about international student support, which is particularly important for your department because you actually have the largest number of international students. So this is who we are. We're small but mighty, we like to say. I'm a faculty in the Department of Health Behavior, and part of my time is I serve as the Associate Dean for Global Health, which means I support global training, research, and practice across all departments. Naya is our full-time director of the office, and then we also have a student RA who is in our MPH program in global health. So our scope of work aligns with the three pillars in the school around education, training, research, and practice. In terms of our work in the space of education and training, we do a lot of work to support international students. As every department does, we try to fill in some of the gaps. A lot of our time is spent on trying to advocate for funding for international students, to try to work with the graduate school to get more tuition remission awards, to try to work with advancement, to try to get more philanthropic funds for student, international students, and to try to help students who are already here fill in some of their funding gaps, in addition to other support and social support that we do for international students. I'm also the lead for the MPH concentration in global health, so I've done a lot of work on our global health training curriculum in that concentration, but also across the school. We're trying to do more to support our doctoral students. We know there are doctoral students in every department that have a strong focus on global, and so trying to figure out what some of their needs are. One of the things we launched last year was a pre-dissertation award. It's the first time we've been able to offer some funding to doctoral students who are in that pre-dissertation phase, want to go to an international site and start to make those partnerships and connections before they launch into their dissertation. We're going to launch a new BSPH program in community and global health, which will administratively sit within the Department of Health Behavior. So we're starting to focus more on our educational curriculum around BSPH students as well. And then we try to fill in where we hear students talk about gaps in global health training. We try to fill those in and bring external people, adjuncts, alumni. Things like budgeting has come up a lot, and trying to fill in some of those professional development skills that our students want. We run a seminar with the Inclusive Excellence Office, which is very popular, that cuts at the intersection between global and inclusive excellence. And then we work a lot with our partners in medicine to run a symposium that features our global health training across the core international sites. And then we also run a mentoring program for our students. In terms of research, we work a lot with the research office. We're working now to try to create a handbook for individuals who are doing global research to help them navigate around some of the administrative challenges that they face in global work. And particularly for new faculty, it can be really overwhelming to try to just figure out what is the research administration process at UNC and then add a layer of complexity when it's international. So trying to be more supportive of our faculty and helping them understand and navigating through that. We also host collaborators and delegation visits. We do individual consultations with faculty when it comes up around research administration issues, and then networking events as well. In terms of practice, this is a space in which we do a lot of work to identify practice-based opportunities. This is largely for our MPH students. We have relationships with these different organizations or sites listed here to offer regular practicum opportunities for our MPH students. And these are typically opportunities that we seek funding, philanthropic funding for. So we're looking to be able to offer more and expand the opportunities for funded opportunities for our MPH students to have experiences working in some of our international sites. We also manage the school-wide travel award, and then the humanitarian health initiative is an initiative that sits within our office and focuses on service-based internships for students who have interests in humanitarian health. And that will be run by Dr. Dilshad Jaff, who is an alumnus of the school and will be based here at in the Department of Public Health Leadership. In terms of transitioning to international travel approval, we still require, we will always require, this is not going to go away, approval to do international travel. We try to make it as streamlined as possible. For faculty, staff, and postdocs, there's one process, which is you complete an international travel approval form. Those come to our office. I look at those forms. If it's a level one or two country by the State Department standards, those get approved pretty much, sign off and get that right back to you so that you can go ahead and make your arrangements for flights. If it's a level three or four country, it gets approved by me typically, and then goes for another level of approval at the provost. So there is one more step. Most of those level three countries have been approved. It just needs an extra level of review. For graduate students, there's a slightly different process. They're required to go through their mentee, their mentor, to get an advisor approval form first. They then put their request in through the RAISR system. Again, those come to me. I look at those, approve them, and then it goes on from there to the provost office. But it is really important that they do this. We have had a couple of students who have not gone through this process. They've traveled and then they've come back and tried to get some reimbursement for travel and they can't do that. So it is required that they do that. And then tied to the international travel is the international health and evacuation. It is required for all faculty. So this is something, it's a separate process. You do have to register with Janet Hornecki in Risk Management Services. You let her know your name, your department, and your dates and location of travel. She puts you on a list. It's $1.50 a day. It's really the only safety net we have for faculty. If something should happen to you when you travel, either a political crisis, a climate crisis, or a medical crisis, this is the safety net. This is what we would use to help evacuate you. So we do need people to be registered. If you're not registered for that, there is no safety net. The university sort of waives responsibility. So this is kind of really important to emphasize for all travelers, students, faculty, and staff. All right, I'm gonna turn it over.
So, the last part about the insurance said it was a university related business.
Mm-hmm.
So what if I'm traveling internationally on vacation?
Mm-hmm.
But while I'm on vacation, mm-hmm. I might check some email.
I knew you'd ask. Yes.
A call or two.
This is that gray area that we are also trying to figure out what is required. It's come up for students, as you know, who might travel home. International students travel home for the summer, largely for personal reasons, but they might be doing some work on dissertations. Is that considered university affiliated or not? I don't know that we have a clear answer to that.
Waiting on science and security to get back to me on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that goes for both of those slides. So the one about filling out forms.
Yes.
May or may not need to do that.
Right.
Also insurance.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
The insurance also costs $1.50 a day. So it's not, we don't think it's that much. But if you're, the insurance only covers you for when you are on that UNC affiliated trip. So you're going to a conference. You end that conference on a Monday and you decide to go somewhere else from Tuesday to Friday. You're no longer covered under the insurance for your off time.
Yeah.
Okay, so international students, hopefully this is not anything new for you all because you are the department that has the vast majority of our international student population. So we did a landscape analysis about a year ago to kind of see what the departments and programs around the school were doing and also to kind of educate people on what we do in our Office of Global Health. So I'm gonna focus on the things that we do first and then kind of highlight all the great things that you do and provide some recommendations that we've heard from our international students. So we have an international student buddy program that is open to all incoming international students. We email them usually around May to ask if they want to participate in this. We match them with a returning international student. We try and match based on home country first or region and then go from there. So we don't match based upon degree program or department that is later down the road. And so that's really just to help them acclimate, have any questions answered while they're preparing to come to Gillings, and have somebody here that they already have communicated with and hopefully feel comfortable with once they arrive. We also send them an international student welcome guide, which is a web-based guide that has really been influenced by our international students, where it starts from pre-departure information to housing, to hair salons, to grocery stores, pretty much any sort of information that you would want as somebody that's new to the area is on that site. So it's also not a it's not just a great resource for international students, but also for new students that are moving to the area as well. So both of those opportunities are sent to international students or incoming international students in May. Then this past year, we just hosted our second international student orientation, where we invite international students who are new to Gillings to come and get to know one another, start building that community, and meet with our returning international students. And we partner with our International Graduate Student Association to host that event. It's during Gillings Orientation Week. We also host scavenger hunts and potlucks with our International Graduate Student Association to, again, start helping build that community with that with our population. There's a very active WhatsApp group for the international students, and we try and send that out and make that available to all international students. They use it to share information, whether it's events. This past weekend, when there was a football game, people were asking for tickets, if anybody had an extra ticket. So really it's a way for people to share information as well. And then we have hosted webinars for prospective and admitted international students working with the admissions team and engage with current international students to really provide information to those who are interested in coming to Gillings. We've also done training for faculty on creating inclusive classrooms for international students. There will be a new training called Global Zone Training that is through the Writing Center and the International Student and Scholars Services office. And so we will be coordinating, our office will be coordinating with them to host hopefully several trainings. They like to keep those trainings small, and it's to provide training to help create a welcoming climate for our students during their first semester here. And so because I like to keep it small, around 20 faculty and staff for each session, we're hoping to do a couple. And then as Suzanne mentioned earlier, we do a lot of funding advocacy. And then I'll draw your attention to the departments and programs portion of this slide. So when we did the landscape analysis, we asked all the departments what they were doing to support international students. And so for you all, you have said that you do prioritize or try to prioritize funding for international students, whether it's through awards, GRA ships, CA ships, scholarships, because we all know that they don't have the same opportunities as our domestic students in terms of being funded, how our domestic students are. You also have great involvement by your biostats international students as part of, I guess, your leadership team. You involve them. We've heard that from the bios international students. And so other things that other departments are doing, they have their own separate buddy program, whether they call it peer program, big SIB program. And that's where we try and ask them to match international student to help with that transition. And then also faculty and mentor outreach and check-ins, as well as specific orientation modules for their international students. I just want to highlight several university resources for international students. So the International Student and Scholar Services is the one location that our international students really need to know. That's where they need to go as soon as they arrive to check in. But that's also the only entity on campus that should be answering any sort of visa related question for our international students. I will continue to say that throughout this presentation, because every student is unique in terms of their visa. And so please be aware that if they have any questions around visas, they need to speak with Amanda Mills. She's our contact at the International Student and Scholar Services. We also have the Writing Center, and they provide great support around English language. We have had a number of our international students participate in their writing groups, speaking groups, and mini courses, and they've said that it's been really helpful for them. And then also the graduate school has the Preparing International Teaching Assistance Program to help students prepare for being a TA as well. So some updates and reminders. So this past year we looked at, so for those that may not know, our Master of Public Health is not STEM designated. So those students that are in public health data science, they are considered non-STEM. And so we were looking, and what that means is that they only, our Master of Public Health students only have a year of eligibility to work after graduation instead of if we were STEM designated, 3 years of work eligibility upon graduation. So we looked at seeing if we could change what is known as our SIP code from non-STEM to STEM. And after a lot of talking with our peer institutions, and understanding some of the complexities around it, we have decided to not pursue a change from non-STEM to STEM. And we did communicate this to all of our international students in May of last year. We also recently convened a meeting with the doctoral directors of the programs that are considered non-STEM as well. And they have come to the same conclusion of not trying to pursue a change in their code. The major thing about that is that that doesn't mean that we're not going to still pursue this. We're just going to try and make the change at the federal government level of getting our public health code approved for STEM. So we're not done hopefully changing the trajectory of our programs to be STEM designated. And then again, as I said, I will always repeat this, all visa related questions need to be answered by ISSS. And then also something that we've had recently is our international students, they do need to receive approval, which is called CPT, before starting their practicum or internship. And this takes about 2 to 3 weeks to receive approval from ISSS. So all international students do need to start that process as soon as they know what they'll be doing for their practicum or an internship that is located outside of UNC. And UNC Health is not considered UNC affiliated for the purposes of for international students completing a practicum or internship. So they do need to do that. If they do not receive CPT approval, it's considered a visa violation and they're asked to leave the country immediately. And unfortunately, we've had that the past couple summers. So we are trying to make a big push that anything in terms of practicum or internship related, please make sure your international students work with ISSS to get that CPT approval before they start. So some best practices and recommendations, again, prioritizing funding for international students due to their ineligibility for major funding sources and to help with the possibility of receiving a tuition remission because they cannot get in-state tuition status. And also matching international students. If you have a buddy program or thinking of having a buddy program, matching international student to international student within the department. And then also contacting our office, the Office of Global Health, to see if there are other students from some other countries. I know predominantly our students are coming from China, but if you do have any students that maybe are looking or from I use the example of we had a student from Mongolia 1 year and they really wanted to connect with anybody else that was from Mongolia. So we actually reached out to Duke because there wasn't anybody at UNC that was from Mongolia. And so we were able to make that connection with actually a Duke alumni in Cary. So that was really helpful for that student. So if you ever have an international student that wants to connect with others from their home country, we're happy to use our network to hopefully make that happen. Some best practices and recommendations around advising and mentoring. Again, just reminding your international master's students about requesting CPT for their practicum and internship before they actually start. And then something that we've heard a lot from our international students is that a personal outreach by their faculty mentor before they even arrive on campus has been very helpful in terms of their sense of creating that sense of belonging. So just welcoming them and answering any questions that they might have. And then also they have said that regular faculty mentor or program check-ins has been really helpful throughout the academic year. So not just that one time a semester, but some touch points throughout the year. So that's it on international students. And we just wanna let you know to please let us know about anything that you're doing globally, what your students are doing or what your alumni are doing, as we would like to promote that and support that. I do follow you all on X, and you guys are very active on X, I must say. So yeah, it's great to see when you all have visitors coming and yeah, so thank you.
Yeah, about the helping international students get the internship going and apply for CPT. So I had a student in Houston 2019. We had a difficult time getting the CPT, and then so in our student guide, we have the following. I just wanted to see if this sounds right to you. ISSS has a rule that F1 visa holding students are typically ineligible for CPT. They've completed all coursework and have been approved to register for thesis credits only. We say, therefore, it's suggested to use our practicum course, 842, as a mechanism for requesting CPT authorization before registering for thesis credits. And I think I got that student in as an exception, but it was like many, many meetings with ISSS. So that's what we have in our, does that sound right?
I can't say for sure right now. I'd have to actually look at it and then see. It's very I would say double check with ISSS on your exact wording of that. If that's from them, then go with that. But I would also encourage the student to also double check with ISSS, because unfortunately we have had instances where they think they're saying yes to one thing and it's actually something else. So yeah. Always double check.
I just want to ask about the Big Buddy program.
Yeah.
So if there's something going on in the department, is there also something at the school level that they would be matched with multiple Big Buddies?
Yes. So they are. So we have about, I think we matched around 30 incoming or new international students this year. And we do ask are you being matched with somebody in your department? Because then if we also know that the returning international students are from, say, biostats, we do also see then it would make sense if it's from the same country and from the same department that we match them together. So it can kind of be just an easy thing. Yeah.
Any other questions? All right, great. Thank you,
thank you.
Thank you, Susan. All right, so next up, Jamie O'Brien and Brian Andre are going to talk about data compliance and data security. I think Brian is going to start. Brian, can you hear us? You ready to take over?
I can hear you just fine. Do you want me to share my screen, or is someone up there willing to press the slide button for me?
I can do it here.
All right. All right, so I'm Brian Andreg. I'm the Associate Director at the School for Systems and Security. I'm housed in Instructional and Information Systems. I'm also the school's primary information security officer, which at the end of the day means I'm responsible to Michael and the chairs and ultimately the dean for keeping us all abreast of what's the right thing to do when it comes to information security writ large. This topic, this presentation is mainly about research security compliance. I know this department doesn't do the most with IRB compared to other groups, but it's much more than IRB. Grants and contracts often have compliance requirements. The Office of Sponsored Programs come to us with compliance requirements. Data use agreements often have compliance requirements as well. So keep that in mind. Also, my pitch, I'm happy to talk about information security to your students, to your research groups, and about all aspects of it, including international travel, because there are places people travel that are very difficult to engage in UNC work by federal legislation anymore, namely China and its territories. There's a lot of requirements due to the National Defense Reauthorization Act that prohibit a lot of work in that space. Next slide, please. So don't panic. Whether it's the IRB or another data use requirement, there's no need to panic. We'll talk it through and we'll figure out what's going to work for everyone. Next slide, please. So in the case of IRB research security compliance, we had a lot of questions about how people engage with the IRB, what happens when you get an email from the IRB about data security levels. Even if you've applied for your study to be exempt or said it's non-human subjects facing, what does this mean and who can I talk to about it are the big questions we get. Next slide, please. So you can talk to me. Again, I'm the school's primary information security officer. I'm going to immediately jump to the bottom of the slide. In your department, you also have very strong support from Scott and David. And if you're in CSCC or doing work in that space, from Carl and Bill. So there's plenty of people to talk to about it. And I'm available all the time via all these different ways. Next slide. So what is the IRB data security level process? The main thing I want to call out here is that if you submit through the IRB, you're automatically assigned a data security level. That is without human intervention. And the instrument for assigning that level is very coarse. Essentially, if you have any identifier at all, name, email, phone number, anything else that would qualify, you're automatically a level 2. If it's that and anything that's deemed sensitive as far as a research type, that's a level 3. That happens before anyone looks at your exemption requests or your NHSR requests. So again, don't panic. Once the analysts review, they set a final data security level, accept or decline the request for exemptions. And then we will have a conversation. Sometimes there's a little timing issue in the automated system. And so at the same time, you're being told you're exempt, you're being told you've got a data security level assignment. We'll talk it through. Next slide, please. Practically speaking, this is what I discussed before. Almost everything starts at a level 2. Most things end at a level 2. I did a quick review of URBIS for BIOS. You have a lot of exemptions. And so that's just all manageable. And data level data 2 is just what we consider good hygiene these days. Next slide, please. So in context, the campus does have an information classification standard. I encourage you all to go to policies.unc.edu and give it a quick review just so you know it's there. The tiers of information align in a crosswalk across the data security levels and then also our security control standard, what you have to do, that is. Next. Thank you. So level 2 controls, as I said, good hygiene. Gillings managed devices meet these requirements. The operating system is supported by the vendor. That means it's a modern version of Windows, Mac OS, or Linux. There's some kind of antivirus or malware installed. Most of these come built in these days, no cost additions necessary. You keep your operating system and applications patched and up to date. What this means is when Windows bothers you about a software update, when it's convenient, you apply that update. And you don't just put it off and put it off and put it off and put it off forever. Eventually, it will force you to apply the update. And I guarantee that always seems to happen right before you want to teach a class and your computer is busy rebooting. Same with applications. They all will tell you these days when there's an update available. When it's convenient for you, apply the updates. I apply mine Fridays, 4 p.m. Your login requires a password from Sleep or Hibernate or Boot. That password meets onion level complexity. On Windows computers that are Gillings managed, this will be your onion password. If you're using another device like a Mac or a Linux-based device, I just encourage you to keep it in sync with your onion. That's what I do. Whole disk encryption is enabled. These tools are built into the operating system. You can find them in the system settings. And depending on your research, you make use of secure storage. And I'll talk about those options in a second. Next slide, please. So what does level three add to it? The big one it adds is vulnerability scanning, which makes use of a software package provided by one of our vendors. Very easy to manage for Gillings managed computers. Harder for students because there's a manual engagement involved of having them install the software rather than us pushing the software. Not impossible, just harder to do. Next slide, please. So where can I put my stuff if I need a secure place to put my stuff? Next slide, please. Approved for all levels of research and for other information types that fall into those security classifications. Microsoft Teams, SharePoint, which is the storage underneath Teams, UNC provisioned cloud environments. We have some stuff in AWS, some stuff in Azure, some stuff in Google. Those are approved. They're approved for use with external collaborators. They're not approved for credit card numbers or social security numbers. I hope your research doesn't involve any of those. If you don't need to collaborate with an external collaborator, individual OneDrive on campus storage through the secure storage environment or the research computing secure workspace are all very useful places. Next slide, please. What's not approved? Dropbox, Box, personal cloud storage accounts. We don't have contractual relationships with these organizations that give us the compliance overview we need to meet the requirements that we have from the federal government and the state government and a great number of funding agencies. Also important, if something goes wrong while using one of these, we don't have a way of helping you out with it. You may work with an external collaborator who, through their institution, has licenses that cover the use of these products. It's important to know who's responsible at the end of the day for IRB oversight or other kinds of compliance requirements. If you have questions, feel free to talk to Scott or David, Carl, Bill, or myself. Next slide, please. So research computing secure workspace. If you have very highly regulated data and you need a place to put it, research computing essentially offers secure enclaves that you remote desktop into and are able to work from. They meet pretty much every data use agreement that the Office of Sponsored Projects in the Vice Chancellor for Research's office will agree to, including very high levels of federal requirements like FedRAMP. It is challenging to get data in and out because it does require use of some older technologies some of us grew up with, like FTP. But it does support most of the software you want to use. And if that software is not available, it can be installed. Next slide, please. So what if you're told you have to meet higher levels of compliance requirements? There's a whole dictionary of acronyms and regulations. Who will help you out? Next slide, please. Not surprisingly, we will help you out. The Gillings Research Group, Alexia Kelly and Carrie North, I, again, Scott, David, Carl, Bill, depending on where you sit, the Vice Chancellor for Research, Penny Gordon-Lardon's organization will help you. the Office of Sponsored Research and Sponsored Projects, UNC's Information Security Office, and the Office of University Counsel. We will all work with you to make sure we're doing the right thing. Next slide. And now we're off to Jamie, unless there's questions for me.
Any questions for Brian?
Sorry, we're just kind of going to swing around back here. Mine is far less, I guess, data and a lot more research compliance than Brian's. He is the data security person, and I am compliance. Hi. I have been here before to talk to you guys a couple of times, and I'm happy to be back. This is more of a compliment to his slides. I'm just going to talk to you a little bit about some of the definitions when we're talking about data compliance, a little bit about why do we care, like why even come and talk to you guys about this, some of the responsibilities that you guys have as investigators, some of the regulatory requirements that you need to look out for, and then a couple of the like weird things that might stick out to you as you go about your research, like data use agreements, which are some fun ones. So I think the key definitions, which I think are things that Brian has already gone over, are the tiers of the sensitive data. These are unique to sensitive data in itself is not unique, but the tiers are unique to UNC. And I think that they are important to understand because it is kind of a little bit of a shock value when you get that email, especially if you have students on your studies. Sometimes they're just like, what do you mean? I have some sort of like restricted or confidential information, especially when you have already told them that your data is, you know, de-identified or anonymized, which again, I am going to say is an important slide to maybe sometimes define, because this is one, as an ethicist, that I like to say, we like to conflate these two terms, I think, in passing. Sometimes we say, oh, you know, my de-identified data or my anonymized data, and we just kind of don't separate those in a way that is maybe far enough apart from each other. So I think ensuring that we have these two explicit definitions for our students and for our RAs and anyone who's working on the projects with us, when they get that, you know, the confidential versus the restricted, might help them a little bit more. So this is a really interesting definition that, because we are not a HIPAA covered entity as UNC, you know, we might still deal with protected health information, which is important to, you know, make sure that for our participants, we are being very careful. However, in a lot of your research, I'm assuming that if you are working with protected health information, you are using it as a part of a study that you're working in collaboration with an entity that is a covered health entity, and therefore you are probably covered under their HIPAA, and you will need to abide by their HIPAA waivers or their HIPAA forms that they're requiring their participants to sign. So those are the HIPAA identifiers. I'm sure you know them. This is not new information to anybody, but just to be sure, as we're going along and talking about the things that we're saving on our computers and where we're saving them, just ensuring that, you know, I came and talked to you guys about like taking our laptops places and, you know, where we're storing our laptops in our cars. These are the kinds of things, like if we're only saving them on, you know, the local drive of our laptop, and then we have something with these kinds of identifiers, that's something that's going to become a bigger problem for us. And for Brian, who I'm sure loves to get that call, you know, on a Friday when he's trying to just update his computer. Mm-hmm. So this is my big spiel for everybody. My top priority in this, I have very little knowledge when it comes to data and security, but my biggest thing is protecting research subjects, protecting research participants and all of their data. That's what got me into this job. That's what got me into this line of work. So I want to make sure that we're protecting all of these subjects, protecting their data, and ensuring that when they decide to participate in research, we're respecting all of this that they're giving us. So the types of data sets that they have is going to kind of drive what is going to be the types of protections that we need to give them. So do you have PHI? What kinds of classifications has your research been deemed locale? So are you working remotely? Are you at home or are you connected to EduRome? Are you working internationally? Are you on campus? What kind of technology do you have? All of these things are going to be driving the different types of protections that you need. And then another one that comes up is your IP and your research vulnerability. So are you saving, analyzing, or working on unpublished work, and who is it funded by? So if you're working on, IP that is funded by a sponsor and, you know, you want to take it to Cuba, that's going to be way bigger of a risk that we're going to have to run through Brian and through the global working group. And that's going to be a bigger data security issue that we're going to have to lock down than if you are working at home on, you know, an unsponsored research project. That is kind of what goes into all of these things that we want to make sure that we're kind of keeping abreast of when we think of these protections. So your responsibilities, I think, understanding the technical needs that come with your specific research and its classifications when you get these emails, abiding and understanding the locality requirements if you're working offsite, if you're bringing your laptop somewhere, if you're going to go overseas, if you're going to go even to a different state, just being aware that you are transporting a laptop with data on it. That is something that right now we don't have an HR person. Gretchen has left. And so I know the last time I came and talked to you guys, there was maybe some talk about whether or not that international travel had domestic concerns. And so we haven't actually figured that out yet, whether or not we have to report domestic travel. Because in all likelihood, I mean, the types of things that happen flying from, here to India could happen in an airport flying from here to Charlotte. Like, someone could steal your laptop anywhere. And if you have some sort of PHI on your laptop, it is kind of the same risk. So that is not to say that there's a mandate in place right now. We don't know how we're going to work out that policy, but it is something to just be aware of. Investigators are responsible for reporting breaches of data security policies in a timely manner. I think that you guys got a copy of these slides. If not, I can send them out to you guys. At the end, there is a bunch of clickable links, including how to report breaches of data. And you can also just click it through to the ethics line. I'm sure if you just type in UNC ethics line, there's like a bunch of things that come up, and it's just a big phone, and you can just click it and you can report your data breach. And also ensuring that your study team, your students, your RAs, your project managers are all aware of data safety hygiene for study documents, which includes where to save and where not to save, all of the things that Brian just told us. These are just a few of the regulatory requirements that might pop up. Like I said, Gillings as a whole is not a HIPAA-covered entity, but UNC Health is, if you're partnering with them, or if you are double employed over there. High tech is part of the EHR, and then GDPR is sometimes built into most of our IRB applications anyways now. Data use agreements. So if you are receiving research materials, or you are exporting research materials, including data out from the university or in from a university, that will go through OSP. And this is another really important thing, because where are you going to save these and who is going to manage them? So if you have any questions about receiving these or sending them off, it's really important that you get in touch with the right side of OSP. If it is from a corporation, it's going to be a different side of OSP than if it's another university. So if you have any questions about those types of partnerships where you are receiving or sending off research data, please feel free to get in contact with me and I can send you off to the right kinds of places. And then there's my contact and Brian's contact at the end. I am a big policy person and some more resources, and that's it. I'm all done. Thanks. I hope that wasn't too painful for you guys.
Does anyone have any questions?
Any questions?
So lastly, Mike Love is going to give us a brief tutorial on LinkedIn.
Perfect. Yeah. Very, very brief. So hi, everybody. Good to see you. So we have there's a social media group within the web committee, and it's Shi Hao and I, and then we've also had a lot of help recently from Liz Bradshaw. So I don't know if she's online, but what I want to talk to you about is we're kind of thinking about strategies of social media for the department. And we have, as people were saying, like a pretty active Twitter or X page. And then we're also been building in this direction. So a month ago, Liz Bradshaw created a LinkedIn page for the department. And I'll show you that. And then we're going to in October, I think October 11th, we're going to meet with the BSA to talk about strategies for promoting themselves, their research, turning their PhD or wherever they are in their graduate program, turning that into, you know, career and networking opportunities. So I told Tanya I'm going to use some pictures from Tanya's LinkedIn because I think it's a great example of like, how can faculty use LinkedIn to talk about things going on? So this is great because we're getting, you know, linking to all the people and we get to see how well our faculty are doing. And this was like a really great accomplishment for Tanya. And you can see like lots of people are appreciating it and commenting on it. And so what are now having a department LinkedIn, the department UNC Biostat can come in and promote that. And that becomes then a place where you can kind of see all the activity going on and it's good for, you know, recruiting faculty, it's good for recruiting students, et cetera. This is just to show you that like other departments are using this pretty effectively. So this is, you know, down the street at Wake Forest, Sarah Lotzbeisch is posting about what they're doing in their department. And you can see Sarah has tagged a bunch of faculty and you can, you know, go in and see everybody's profile. So I would highly recommend creating a LinkedIn profile and then go follow UNC Biostat. I'll show you how to do that. And I was really active on Twitter and then I quit about a year ago because it was like the signal to noise ratio was not right for me. It was like they were changing the algorithm to give you a lot of content that wasn't, you know, it was great for science and stats, honestly, for a long time. And then for me, it didn't work. The department's still on Twitter X. That wasn't abandoned, but like, I find this to be actually a really good place to see people post papers, see, you know, students, you get to learn about students. Maybe you want to recruit them as postdocs. People are posting about conferences, encouraging people to sign up for conferences. This is like, this is more in the bio, you know, genomics space on the left side. And this is the data science schools posting. So you can, you know, hear about things going on off campus or on campus. This is great. I want everybody to do this. So have the student post about the paper with a link and then the faculty promotes it. Quotes it and distribute it to sit broad, more broadly. So that way the student gets credit. People click through and maybe follow the student because they're interested. Who's this, you know, who's Jesus? What are they up to? So this is perfect. And then the department can then promote that, you know, if it sees fit. I'm going to skip over that. This is just like a week ago, I was posting some stuff about papers that came out and then like, it's great. Like it does lead to interesting conversations. So here I'm talking with, you know, some people in my field and getting down into the details of the paper. So it's a great place to carry on these conversations. Our graduates are talking about where they are in their career, and they're getting a lot of attention. Like Anshi from my lab, you know, she's got 240 people in her network here that are, you know, congratulating her on her promotion. Ethan, you know, going off to GSK, like you get, it's also really seems to be very active with our alumni. So it's like a continuous, we want to have this continuous presence when they're in the department, when they're out, and then off to different careers. So other departments have LinkedIn, UW, UT, Austin, UT Health. Here's our department, just created again by Liz Bradshaw a month ago, but you can go and follow this. So you can just type UNC Biostat. That should give you, if you're on LinkedIn, you should be able to, you know, see this, and you can follow this, follow the department. Yeah. And that's it. So we're going to talk about this to the students, because I really think, you know, faculty may or may not want to create a LinkedIn page, but I do think it's going to be great for the students to have this and have all their content kind of in a place. So you can go, you can click on UNC Biostat and you can see like, these are students talking about their papers that they're putting up either as preprints or publications. Any questions?
It's really great. Thanks, Mike, so much. I joined LinkedIn recently also. It's just a really great way to connect with alumni and colleagues at other universities. It's once you're on, it's so easy. You know, you just all of a sudden someone pops up from your past and you're connected with them, and then you're getting a chat from a student who was in your class in 2008 asking how you're doing. It's really fantastic. So it doesn't take a lot of effort, I guess. You can really get up and running quickly. And so I would encourage folks to do that. Andy Green?
Who, if we wanted to share things on the department page, is that you, Liz, or someone?
Right now, Liz Bradshaw is holding the keys
okay.
to that because, yeah, we don't have enough dedicated person. But Liz is, that's her position within the CSCC.
Okay. Yeah, but the department outside of the CSCC is covering part of her time now to where the communications have that
okay.
previously was in.
Okay.
Yeah, so Liz Bradshaw.
Okay.
All right, well, we're at time. Should be cookies and coffee upstairs. And then seminar at 3:30. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.